We're holding Parashat Emor. And as usual, we're going to begin with an overview. We'll quickly run through the Parashah and then go over it with more depth. Our Parashah begins with commandments to Aaron and the Kohanim that they are not allowed to become Tameh, to become spiritually defiled by coming in contact with or in the same tent as the average person that dies. There are exceptions. The average Kohen may become Tameh for their father, mother, son, daughter, sister, brother, wife. A Kohen Gadol, the high Kohen, he is more limited. He may not become Tameh for anyone except for a Met Mitzvah, which we'll discuss. The Torah says that even though the Torah is allowing them to become Tameh for their relatives, they have to remember not to get carried away. They're not allowed to start shaving their heads or their beards in ways that aren't permitted, even though the nations of the time used to do this as signs of mourning. You're not allowed to take a razor and start cutting off the hair of your beard or etc. They're not allowed to scratch. That's one of the things that people used to do when they lost their relative. They draw blood, and the Torah forbids that. The Torah expands their holiness that they're also supposed to be careful who they marry. And this is relevant to people here. Those of you who are Kohanim, take note. A Kohen is forbidden to marry a woman who's a divorcee. And this is also today. A woman who's halala, meaning that maybe we'll get to discuss, or a woman who's a zona, and that we'll also discuss. They have to marry women, a widow they could marry, but it has to be a woman who did not have improper relationships, and more details we'll try to fill in when we go over it again. A Kohen Gadol must marry a young girl of age 12 who is a virgin, etc. Kohen Gadol is more limited. But a regular Kohen only has these prohibitions. The reason this is applicable is because very often if a girl became a Giyoret at an age over 3, which is when most girls become, if they're going to become a Ger, so we assume that improper things might have happened, and therefore a Kohen is not supposed to marry her. Yeah? Right?
So then what happened if you'd married someone that was allowed to be a Kohen but not allowed to become a Gadol?
That's okay. It's, you're saying if he married, I don't remember. I think that's okay, but I don't remember.
Because a Kohen Gadol wasn't usually someone who wasn't married.
Right? Maybe we'll get a chance to touch on that. Maybe. So the Kohen Gadol has special commandment. He's if he loses a relative, he's not supposed to mourn. The Torah says he could continue in his service in the temple, in the Beit HaMikdash. A regular Kohen may not. Once he loses a relative, he has to stop what he's doing and go mourn for the relative. The Torah tells us that Kohanim are not allowed to have blemishes. And the Torah enumerates many different kinds of blemishes. A person's missing the bridge of his nose. A person has a huge one. His left arm is very big and his right arm is very small. All kinds of different blemishes. The Torah says they may not serve as Kohanim in the temple. The Torah tells us that there's a special warning. Kohanim have to be extra careful with the laws of purity there. There are representatives and they're serving in the Beit HaMikdash, so they have to be extra careful. And their servants, their avadim knanim, are allowed to eat from some of their food, even though it's holy, because we say that the kohen owns more than just the monetary value of the person's time. The kohen owns the person when it comes to an avid knani, and therefore the kohen may feed him holy foods, because we say part of the ownership extends to his isurim, to his prohibitions, to his religious life, meaning the ownership is not only a monetary ownership. We say when a kohen owns an evet kanani, so that just like, I don't mean to compare, but it's understandable that when a kohen marries a woman, so then that woman may eat some of the holy foods that he made. The Torah says which yes and which not. Now, before she got married, she was not allowed to eat them. Now that she's married to a kohen, we say, well, she became Mrs. Kohen. She got some of his holiness. Well, that holiness extends not only to his wife, it extends to other things as well, his animals, kohen may feed certain truma to his animals. If he gets truma that's animal feed, so he could give it to his animals. And it extends to his Eved Kanani as well. Let's say a kohen has a daughter, so the Torah says she loses her kohen status the second she marries a regular Israelite. If she becomes divorced or widowed, if she has no children, so she gets back her kohen status. She could again eat the foods. If she does have a child or a grandchild left from that marriage, so that forces her to remain without her kohen status. What happens if a person by mistake eats truma? He eats from the holy foods of the kohanim, the truma, and it's a mistake. So the Torah says he must add a fifth. And here we're going to have a discussion, what does the Torah mean when the Torah says a fifth? We're accustomed to doing math one way, and we're going to see that the Torah teaches the Torah way of doing math is slightly different. Or really the math isn't different, but the terminology is different. We're holding by Shlishi. The Torah tells us that when we bring animals as sacrifices, so we also have to be careful that the animals don't have blemishes. And the Torah tells us that when an animal is born, it may not be brought forth until the eighth day. We know a child cannot have a bris milah till 8 days. So to an animal, it must be given 7 days of life before it can be brought as a sacrifice. The Torah gives us a special prohibition from slaughtering a mother and its calf on the same day. And this is relevant in general. The Torah tells us that we have to be careful that to keep the Yom Tovim. And our parsha ends with Shabbos and then an enumeration of the Yom Tovim. And we have Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur and Pesach and Shavuos and Sukkot and the mitzvahs that each one has. The mitzvah of Pesach, to eat matzah for 7 days, the sacrifices of Pesach. The part of the mitzvah of Pesach is within Pesach where to bring a special sacrifice called the Omer sacrifice. Here the Torah tells us that before we start harvesting our barley, which is the first harvest ordinarily in Israel, it starts on Pesach. So before we start our first harvest, we are forbidden from taking from the first crops until the first crop is brought in the Beis HaMikdash. And that's the sacrifice that has a volume of an Omer. That sacrifice was brought the morning after the Pesach, meaning the first day of Chol HaMoed. And that sacrifice is called the Omer. Really, Omer is volume. And yeah.
Why do we count Omer every day in the Omer?
And the Torah tells us that after bringing that sacrifice, we're to count 49 days until the next holiday of Shavuos. We're to count 7 weeks, 49 days, and that'll bring us to the next holiday. And the Torah does not identify the date when Shavuos is. The Torah says from the morning, from the time you bring the Omer, which is the morning after the first day of Pesach, right? We have the first day of Pesach, and then we have the first day of Chol HaMoed, which is in Chutzar, it's the second day of Pesach.
Why is it called Omer?
So this sacrifice is called the Omer sacrifice because it is the volume of an Omer.
Mm-hmm.
This sacrifice that's brought that morning.
Right, the day after Pesach, but why are we still...
And we are to count from that Omer, the Torah says. From that Omer count, 49 days, 7 weeks. So that's why we call it the counting of the Omer. We say tonight was 30 days. We started the 30th day from the time of the bringing of the Omer, which equals 4 weeks and 2 days, right? So we count the weeks and we count the days, as the Torah tells us in our parsha, that we are to count the weeks and the days, 49 days, 7 weeks, we are to count from the bringing of the Omer. So the bringing of the Omer was that morning, the morning of the first day of Chol HaMoed. And here, the Torah tells us to do it regardless, even if it's Shabbos. So if it's Shabbos, you still have a mitzvah to harvest. Ordinarily, we're forbidden from harvesting on Shabbos. Here, the Torah tells us, nonetheless, we are to harvest that the Omer. And no, harvesting is one of the actions that's prohibited on Shabbos. The Torah tells us we're not allowed to eat any bread or roasted kernels of grain. Any of the new crop is forbidden until that sacrifice is brought. And this prohibition applies today as well. That's what's called chadash, the new wheat that's going to be harvested from Pesach and on. That wheat... now it's permitted because we say that the Torah says when you could bring the Omer permits it. And when you can't bring the Omer, so the date permits it. But following that date, the new harvest is permitted. Meaning, let's say you live in Nebraska and you want to harvest new wheat for the matzah you're going to eat on Pesach. So you have a problem. You have a problem eating that new wheat if you're going to harvest it before Pesach. So we'll discuss that. When the prohibition applies, when it doesn't apply, we have to discuss that. Yeah?
That's kind of a parallel because according to the Torah, it's also the date. I mean, it's on the first day of Cholamot Pesach, that's when the... It's not when the crop is ready.
From that time on.
Right. Ah, so
from that time on, everything you harvest is okay.
But I mean, the harvest of the first crop is not like, it doesn't say when it looks ready, when the grains look ready to harvest. It says no, on this date you should.
It says from that date you may eat that harvest. You're allowed to harvest. You're not allowed to eat.
No.
You're not allowed to eat any of the harvest until that date, until the morning after the first day of Pesach. So we count 7 weeks, 749 days, and on the 49th, when we hit Shavuos, so the Torah tells us, now you bring a sacrifice of chametz. This is one of the exceptions when we bring chametz in the Beis HaMikdash. Ordinarily, the Torah prohibits us from bringing chametz in the Beis HaMikdash, and this is one of the exceptions. We're supposed to bring 2 loaves of bread on Shavuos, and these are the loaves that are called the first loaves, so to speak, of Hashem. They are bikurim. And from the time those are brought, we may bring from the new harvest in the temple. Until those are brought, so we don't bring from the new harvest in the temple, but we may eat the new harvest. Now, the way the harvest worked in Israel was they'd start harvesting the barley on Pesach and start harvesting the wheat on Shavuos. Barley was used as animal feed. People didn't eat it. And Shavuos was used for bread. Wheat was used for bread. Wheat was used for mankind. And here the Kabbalists and the Hasidim all discuss how we're supposed to evolve during these 49 days from Pesach to Shavuos. On Pesach we bring a mincha, we bring a sacrifice that's all barley, animal food. And we're supposed to evolve from the level in which we left Egypt and evolve to the level we were when we received the Torah, where we became humans the way we should be. Yeah.
So there is a connection.
Just a second. Yeah.
So it says Hasidic custom, but in the Sefirot Omer we always have like I see Ashkenazi Siddurim that has the Sefirot, the Malchut, the Malchut, the Chesedim, which are Kabbalistic concepts, so they're brought into even kind of mainstream davening.
You have to ask those who say it. I don't say it.
You don't say the daven Ashkenaz?
Yep.
But it has in a lot of Ashkenazi.
I know.
There's a connection between the first, second day of
Pesach. And correct. There's definitely a connection. Not only is there a connection, but this used to
that
be.
That was my question. Why do we call this the 30 days of the Omer? Because on the 49th day we bring these 2 loaves of bread.
On the 50th day we'll bring the 2 loaves of bread, but we're counting from the Omer sacrifice. That's what we're counting. Yeah. You want something? You.
I was just going to ask, might be a stupid question, but
I haven't heard a stupid question ever. Yeah.
Omer,
yeah.
Is that year's harvest?
Yeah.
So what is the harvest? Is that the time?
And Pesach is when they'd start harvesting the barley.
So, no, but someone has to harvest it before Pesach.
No, there was a special harvest. Part of the mitzvah of the Omer is harvesting the Omer. There was a special mitzvah that even if it fell on Shabbos, there's a mitzvah to actually harvest Omer. They'd harvest a certain amount of barley, they'd grind it, and then they'd sift it, all actions which are ordinarily prohibited on Shabbos, and then they'd bring that sacrifice in the Beis HaMikdash.
So what happens if the barley
So that might be cause for the Beis Din to make the year a leap year, if they see that the harvest isn't coming out right, because Pesach is supposed to fall out this time of year, so we have control over the calendar. Ellie, yeah.
Is there an essence of Sefirot Omer, or maybe we're counting, and it's a bridge, numbers that are acting as a bridge, we're counting as acting as a bridge. But is there an essence of Sefirot Omer, like, I don't know.
Let's see if we could get a better answer for that when we go more in depth.
Sorry, but how's the reason you don't say it? Because it seems to be
First, the main reason is it's not my custom. My custom isn't to say it, yeah. Okay. In the middle of this discussion of the holidays, the Torah suddenly tells us that when we harvest, we have certain commandments of leaving over for the poor. Leaving over the corner of the field, leaving over if you drop a stalk or two stalks. What's going on here? This seems to be interjected. What's this doing here? Maybe we'll get to discuss that. The Torah continues with the Jewish calendar starting from Pesach, Nisan. We've gone to Sivan, to Shavuos. And now we move forward to the seventh month, to the first of the seventh month. And the Torah says you have a holiday then, a remembrance of blowing, a holiday. What's going on that holiday? The Torah doesn't call it Rosh Hashanah. The Torah doesn't tell us blow shofar. Torah leaves it very enigmatic. What's going on? We don't know. The Torah just says you have a holiday. So we'll discuss later what really is going on and why does the Torah not tell us anything beyond this. And then on the 10th day, you have a day of atonement called Yom HaKippurim, the Day of Atonement. You're supposed to hurt your souls. V'initem et nafshotechem. How do we hurt our souls? Do we separate from our wives? Do we not wash ourselves? Do we not anoint ourselves? What do we do? What's it called to hurt ourselves? Do we not eat? Okay, do we not put on shoes? So the Gemara discusses all this. Okay.
To afflict ourselves.
And don't do any melacha. It's a day of atonement to atone before Hashem. And whoever doesn't afflict himself, so they'll be cut off. Anyone that does melacha on this day gets kares, they'll be cut off. Don't do any actions. It's a Sabbath of all Sabbaths and hurt yourself from the 9th to the 10th in the evening. So wait a second. Throughout the Torah, when we speak about atonement, we speak about sacrifices. And here, the Torah doesn't tell us which sacrifices to bring, and yet it calls it a Yom Kippurim, a day of atonement. And the Torah is alluding to us that the day itself has the power to atone. That we were not contingent upon the Mishkan and the Beis HaMikdash in order to attain atonement on Yom Kippur, but rather it is Yom HaKippurim, the Day of Atonement. The day itself has power. And that's what we say to this day, that Yom Kippur is a Day of Atonement. We're not doing all of the rituals that the Torah states should be done on Yom Kippur. But that's because here, where the Torah discusses and calls it Yom Kippurim, the Torah doesn't mention those sacrifices, because that's not the main point. The day is a Day of Atonement. We hit the 15th of the month of Tishrei, and we come to Chag HaSukkos, the holiday of Sukkos, of overhangs, of shadings. That's what Sukkah means. Sukkah is from the word Schaf. It's a shading. 7 days. On the first day, we have a day where the Jewish people are supposed to unite. And 7 days, we bring special sacrifices. These are the holidays of Hashem. And we have the sacrifices to bring and our donations. And after it seems like we're summing it all up, the Torah goes back and says, but, don't forget, on the 15th of this seventh month, you have the Yom Tov of Sukkos. We were discussing it. Why'd we go off? The Torah is in the middle of discussing it, and then the Torah sums it up and says, these are all the holidays, and then it goes back like an afterthought. And by the way, on the 15th, when you gather your harvest, so celebrate 7 days. On the first day, you have a day of rest. On the 8th day, you have a day of rest. And on the first day, make sure to take for yourself this beautiful fruit. Doesn't say which fruit. Torah could have said Esrog. Doesn't say that.
So you're just finding these questions. You're not going
to
answer them.
I'm going to try to answer them. We'll see if we have time. Torah identifies it. Take a fruit of a tree that's a beautiful tree. Doesn't say Esrog. Take yourself the branches of a palm tree. Take yourself a branch that is wrapped with leaves, and the aravos that grow by the river. So two were identified, and two were left unidentified, two of the species. Notice also that when the Torah discusses how much of each species, so the Torah says pri, one fruit, for the esrog. Kapos, is that one or plural? We take one lulav, but it seems to say kapos, spelled kapat. Anaf etzavot could be single or plural for our hadasim, which is called a branch that's wrapped with leaves, and our ravos, and be happy before Hashem. Okay, what am I happy with? Torah says be happy. About what? Before Hashem. And celebrate it a day for 7 days. sit in Sukkot for 7 days, so that generations will know that I had the Jews sitting in Sukkot when I took them out of Egypt. And Moshe tells the Jewish people these laws.
So what's the
also, maybe we'll get the answer to that. I don't know. That much, I don't know. We'll see. I saw that they posted on the bulletin board that our class is methodology. So I figure we got to get a little bit of methodology into this class. Okay, now we seem to be going on a tangent. The Torah tells us that we have to take special oil for the menorah, the pure menorah, which we light in the temple. And the Torah tells us about the special bread, that we have 6 piles of bread, we have 12 loaves of bread, and together with the bread we have a special incense called Levona. And the Levona is the only part that's offered to Hashem. The bread is eaten by the Kohanim. And once a week we switch the bread. The bread is supposed to be there permanently. And that's why when we'd switch the bread, they'd like push the bread off. Like one loaf of bread would come in where the other loaf of bread went off, because Torah says that we should always have bread present on the Shulchan, on that table, and the Kohanim get to eat it. And then the Torah ends our parsha with a story. There was the son of a Jewish woman who went out. Well, isn't everyone the son of a Jewish woman? So no, everyone's the son of a Jewish woman and a Jewish man. And this man was the son of a Jewish woman and a Mitzri man. Seems to be an intermarriage. So we'll discuss that. And this son of this Jewish woman, he went out. Doesn't say where he went out from. Doesn't say where he went out to. But he went out. He went out among the Jewish people and he started fighting him and another Jewish man. And he cursed. Not someone, but rather the holy name. And they brought him before Moshe. His mother's name was Shlomis Bas Divri from the tribe of Dan. And they kept him in watch to ask Hashem what to do. And Hashem said he should be stoned. And that's what was done. And they taught the law that no man may curse. We all have to be careful with Hashem's name. And the Torah ends, seems to go, and if you kill someone, you get killed. If you kill an animal, you have to pay. And if someone wounds someone else, the Torah says a break for a break, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, but really we have a tradition that this means payment. And the Torah ends by telling us that there should be one legal system. You know, no nepotism. A ger gets the same treatment as an ezrach, as a citizen. And after telling us all of these laws were said when they asked, what should we do with this man that cursed? So God said, all of this whole long series of laws, and then they took him out and they stoned him. Well, what does this have to do with the story? So we have a lot of questions. Now let's start going in depth and see how many of them we can answer. Sorry, Michael. We're not going to answer all of them. I don't think so. Okay. Parsha begins. Hashem tells Moshe to talk to the Kohanim and say to them. So we have a double terminology here. Talk to the Kohanim and say to them, "Emor laKohanim v'amarta aleihem." This is one of a few examples where the Torah uses a double lashon, a double terminology. We had another example last week with regard to the shratzim, the creepy crawly creatures. That was 2 weeks ago. We had another example last week with regard to eating blood. And here the Torah says it about becoming tameh. The Torah teaches us on these three commandments regarding eating blood, regarding eating the creepy crawly creatures and being careful with the creepy crawly creatures and tumah. The Torah tells us about these three things that we have to watch the kids. That the kids, we're responsible for the kids as well. It's not enough that we ourselves keep these laws, we're responsible for the kids. So before we enter this arena, we have to ask ourselves, there's a mitzvah of chinuch. Right? I have to educate my kids. And the Torah teaches us that the mitzvah of chinuch revolves around when a child understands. Now, the mitzvah of chinuch has to be broken down. There's the mitzvah of chinuch that I'm responsible to teach my son Torah. And then there's the mitzvah of chinuch that's rabbinic, that the rabbis instituted. Biblically, a child before he's 13 and produces 2 hairs in the pubic area or in some area that shows maturity. For a boy, it's 13 years of age. For a girl, it's 12 years of age. Prior to this time, biblically, he's not responsible to perform mitzvot. And the rabbis instituted that we have to train our children to do mitzvot. So once a child understands how to wear a talis and tzitzis and wear it correctly, so we put him a little tzitzis. Once a kid knows how to make blessings, we teach him how to make blessings. Once a kid knows what Shabbos is, so we teach him he doesn't turn on a light on Shabbos. So we have to ask ourselves, what's exceptional about here? Is this telling us that even a child that hasn't reached the stage of chinuch, we're responsible to watch him? A 1-year-old baby kohen may not enter a cemetery. So simple understanding is that's what it's saying. That even a 1-year-old baby may not enter a cemetery. We're responsible to watch our kids from age 0. So if you have a 1-year-old child and the child doesn't know much and you want to get him the toy of the times, the Gemara says that if you wanted to make your kid happy, they used to give him a grasshopper and say, "Here, Chaim, play with this." And the kid would play with the grasshopper and eventually pluck off its head. So this was the toys that in those times they'd give it to him. So you'd have to get a kosher grasshopper. You can't give the kid a non-kosher grasshopper. You're responsible to watch what your kid eats. What? Chagav. You have to know which chagav are kosher.
Right, but they used to give the chicken head. The chicken head is, you can't just eat the raw chicken head.
Who said you can? Who said you can? They probably clean off the blood and then bon appetit. I just want to quote a section from the Mishnah Brura and the laws of Shabbos, because people sometimes take this too lightly. Now, our class isn't in halacha, so I'm not saying anything halacha lemaisa, and you'll have 100 different questions, and I'm not getting into the halachic aspects of this. I just want you to be aware that this is an issue that you have to look into. Because very often people say, oh, the light turned off, so I'll bring the kid over. So they call a 5-year-old kid and they say, "Do you know what to do with the switch?" So he says, "Sure," and he turns it on. 5-year-old kid, he's got a pretty good concept that today is Shabbos. So some people want to be more pious. So they take a 2-year-old kid. Well, I could hear a 2-year-old kid, but I'm just going to quote a section from the Mishnah Brura. There's a siman in Hilchos Shabbos, in Shin Mem Gimel, that discusses the laws of a child, and I just want to quote a section from the Mishnah Brura. And again, I'm not saying halacha l'maisa, this is what you have to do. I'm just saying be aware of what it says. Asur l'chol adam. The Shulchan Aruch had said that if a child starts eating non-kosher food, so then the courts don't have to interfere. The father has a mitzvah of chinuch to yell at him and say, "Stop eating the chazir." But if a 7-year-old or a 10-year-old child starts eating non-kosher, then the courts don't have to interfere. If an adult comes and wants to eat non-kosher, then the courts will beat him up. Say, "You're a Jew, you can't eat non-kosher." This is when the courts have power. And the Jews are on a level where this wouldn't cause destruction. Today, even if the courts had power, they wouldn't do it. But if a 10-year-old boy or girl is starting to eat non-kosher food, so the courts don't have to interfere, his father has to interfere. But to give him to eat, if someone wants to take a little kid out to McDonald's and give him to eat non-kosher food, that's prohibited. Even things that are prohibited rabbinically, it is prohibited to give a child to eat. Now this is even if it's not my kid. I just got Lucky Charms in the mail. And I know Lucky Charms isn't kosher. So my neighbor's kid comes over and I say, "Okay, here, have a bowl of Lucky Charms." So he really feels lucky. His parents never give him that. And I say, "Well, I don't have mitzvah chinuch. It's not my kid." So says Shulchan Aruch, "No, no, no. You are not allowed to give even someone else's child, even though it's not incumbent upon you to teach him. You don't have mitzvah chinuch. But you are not allowed to give him something non-kosher, even if it's rabbinically prohibited to eat." Right. We're talking about a Jewish child. So, explains the Mishnah Brura. Lechol adam, for every person it is prohibited to give this child to eat non-kosher, something that's prohibited, even rabbinically prohibited. V'afilu atinok eino b'ravana klal. And even if the baby doesn't understand anything, you're talking about a 1-year-old child. He says, "No mitzvah, chinuch, what mitzvah do I have?" Says the Mishnah Brura, it is forbidden to give that child to eat something that's unkosher. V'daval zeh asur min haTorah. And this, the Torah prohibits. The Torah prohibits any Jew from giving a little child, even a child that's not yet at the age of chinuch, anything that's non-kosher to eat. And we derive it from what we saw 2 weeks ago about shratzim, that the Torah says these creepy, crawly creatures may not be eaten. And we derive from that the fact that the Torah repeats it, that not only may I not eat it, But I have to ensure that kids don't eat it, that little children don't eat it. And the same thing is true with blood, and the same thing is true with our parsha, with Kohanim becoming Tameh. And these three are the prototypes, they are not the exception. From these three we derive to the rest of the Torah, that anything that is prohibited to be eaten or to do, we may not cause a child to do. And therefore, says the Mishnah Brura, it is prohibited to give a child, let's say, I'm not putting it in his mouth, I'm just going to pour some Lucky Charms in the cereal bowl and put it on the floor and leave the room. If he eats it, I didn't get him to eat. Says the Mishnah Brura, no. You're not even allowed to say, hey, you know, this thing can slide across the table, it's really fun, and slide the Lucky Charm across the table. You want to slide it back? I'm playing cook-a-lock with him. I'm not giving it to him to eat. I'm playing instead of dice. I'm playing with Lucky Charms. Says Mishnah Brura, no. Even that is prohibited because he might come to eat it. And then it's considered like I gave it to him to eat. So we have to think, how do we expand this to Shabbos? So I'm putting a child, and I put him near the light switch, and I say, show me how you wave. Show me how you wave. Come on. I'm causing him to turn on that light switch or turn it off. So I'm not going into halacha lemaise. Again, I'm not saying anything is prohibited. I'm not saying anything is permitted. Everything I read, you should know there is such an opinion. You should know that according to Mishnah Brura, we're talking about biblical prohibitions. And what is permitted and what is prohibited, that's a class in and unto itself. But our parsha is one of the sources for this prohibition of causing a child to sin. And this has nothing to do with the mitzvah of chinuch. This is not a discussion of chinuch. Chinuch is when it's my child, I have a mitzvah to teach him before he's bar mitzvah. This isn't a discussion of chinuch. Yeah, someone had questions? Yeah.
This is within methodology. Can you define ochel nefesh?
What does ochel nefesh have to do with it?
Someone came up today and it's like connected to...
Let's do that after class, okay? Yeah.
So it seems to me that the prohibition, the prohibitions regarding Shabbat and Kashrut aren't just a matter of chinuch. It's a Jewish person. It doesn't really matter all there, but the Jewish soul can't experience the desecration of eating unkosher food or desecrating Shabbat.
So the rule is, when you have something bent one way and you want to straighten it out, you have to bend it the other way. So I presented you with one aspect of the halacha. I didn't quote any of where one would be able to be lenient, etc. That's why I don't want to agree with you so easily. I'm not coming here to give people a halachic conclusion. So that if a person is sitting in a house and it's freezing cold and he's got his old grandmother who's 95 and there might be in danger of pneumonia, and he'll say, well, I have a kid here and he'll be happy to turn on the heater for her, but I won't do that. I'm not saying you should, I'm not saying you shouldn't. I'm not entering the halachic arena. I'm just saying, be aware that it's not simple that one may do it, and that from our parsha we derive that there's a prohibition of causing a child to sin. Beyond that, so that deserves at least one class unto itself, which maybe we'll get to do this semester. It's on my agenda. I hope we'll get to it. The Torah speaks to the Kohanim. We have to know that there are two sides, two aspects to Kohanim. There's the aspect that they are the children of Aaron, and there's the aspect that they are Kohanim. The daughter of a Kohen is called Batish Kohen, the daughter of a Kohen, and she is also called the Kohenit. And each person really has at least two strengths acting within him. There's the continuum, the strength that we have from our parents. It could be the fact that I was born Jewish, I was born a Kohen, I was born a Levi, etc. I was born to a certain Shevet. And it could be, and then there's the strength, my own strength. And our parsha focuses on the Kohanim, because our parsha is speaking about their intrinsic kedusha, that each kohen has kedusha, irrespective of whether he is serving in the temple or not. Bnei Aaron, the Torah calls them the sons of Aaron, and stresses that aspect of kedusha when they're serving in the temple. There, they're continuing Aaron. They're continuing as kohanim, but it's not their intrinsic as much as their inherited holiness that they're serving in the temple. Our parsha focuses on their intrinsic kedusha. They're holy, and that's why Kohen today. There's the famous story that Rav Soloveitchik used to quote about a guy who was dating a non-Jewish girl, and he wasn't religious at all. And she told him, "Let's check out your roots a little bit." and they started taking classes together, and she, the guy, and he, the Jew, she became very interested in Judaism, and finally she got him interested, which happens all the time. I'm not encouraging anyone to date a guy, but bottom line, she was very interested, and she converted, she became a Jew, and after a while he did tshuva, and then they decided to get married. And someone told him that the custom that when one loses one's parents, they go to the grave and they bring an invitation, they so to speak invite the parents to the wedding. So a month or so before the wedding, he started researching where his parents were buried, and he went to his father's grave, and he invited his father to come to the wedding, and he saw on the tombstone a sign of two hands in a special shape, and he went and asked his friends, and they told him, yeah, that's the custom of Kohanim. And they came to Rav Soloveitchik to try and find out if there was any leniency for this couple to get married. And Rav Soloveitchik researched it and sadly was forced to tell them that they may not get married after the whole journey they went through. This is a tragic story of two heroes. I don't know if it's tragic. I mean, it's very sad. But it's two people who I hope, I don't know the continuation of the story, I hope they were able to build their lives afterwards. It's two people who lived up to a mitzvah in a very difficult time. But why did they have this mitzvah? Because this mitzvah is set to Kohanim. To Kohanim, the holiness that God gave them is within their DNA. It's intrinsically so. Every Kohen has this holiness. And that's why Kohanim today have to be careful when they take flights with El Al to make sure it's a plane that doesn't have isn't carrying a casket, because Kohanim may not become Tameh still today. And Kohanim, not only may they not become Tameh, but they're not allowed to even walk within 4 footsteps of a casket. Sometimes a Kohen will say, well, casket's right here and I'm here. I'm not Tameh. I'll make sure we don't go under the same overhang. We won't go under the same tree. Doesn't work that way. You have to stay at least 4 footsteps away. I would stay further away. You're playing with fire. It's a biblical commandment. But at least that much. Yeah. Right. I don't. Maybe tomorrow night, if you remind me, we'll go through that. Those people who are Kohanim have an issue with going to the delivery room with their wives.
No,
it's a problem.
They set up a two-door system, so...
It doesn't resolve everything, because the second a person dies, he's not in the morgue.
Yeah, yeah.
He's still in the hospital.
Right.
Just a second, yeah.
Say a Kohen marries a non-Jewish woman, they have a son, and then the son marries a Jewish girl, and they have a son. Is that final son a Kohen? Or does the man...
Maybe you'll be able to derive it from what we say, yeah.
In a plane, there's a separation between the cargo and the thing.
Good question. It's too complicated to go into today. Let him talk to his rabbi. This isn't the class in Aloha now. This is to get a picture of the parsha. Okay, the Torah says that when a Kohen is prohibited from becoming Tameh, this is contingent on the fact that the dead person is within the nation. What happens if a Kohen is walking out in the desert and he finds a carcass? So that carcass is called the Met Mitzvah. What happens if he's in town and he is the high priest, is the Kohen Gadol, and he's a Nazir? He took on a vow, he's not drinking wine, he's got his long hair. So he has a double prohibition, double whammy, not to become Tameh. And Yom Kippur is tomorrow. So all the Jewish people are counting on him. And suddenly, a guy came to town, walking to the bar. He's drinking like a horse, and no one knows him. And they try to get a word out of him, nothing doing. And that night, the Kohen Gadol bumps into that body. And now he sees the body there, and there's no one around. He can't get anyone so easily. So that's a Met Mitzvah. We say that body, even though this person was the lowlife in town, he showed up to town and made a bad name for himself in 2 days, 5 days, and no one knows who he is. We say that body has intrinsic worth. It is B'Tselem Elohim. God created that person in his fashion. And therefore, we have a mitzvah that even a Kohen Gadol, even the high priest, even if it were the eve of Yom Kippur, even if it were a Kohen Gadol who was a Nazir, as much holiness as you can get, the Torah says, take care of that corpse. That was a human corpse. That's a human body lying there. And that, here we have the source of the concept in Halacha of Kvod HaBriot. That we have to honor the fact that we are all Briot, we are all the creations of God. Yeah?
Does that also apply to non-Jews?
Good question. Let's continue. it's too many details to answer that. There is a chance it doesn't apply, but we didn't discuss whether non-Jews are mitame or not. We didn't get into... You're assuming with your question that a non-Jew is mitame.
No, it's because it's the Briot.
So I could just answer you yes or no, but I am guaranteed that there will be a misunderstanding if I answer. The answer is a straightforward yes or no. But in order to understand the yes or no correctly, we need an introduction of 15 minutes. So that's why I'd rather leave it hanging. Because it's a straightforward yes or no. But there's much more in order to understand why it's so. I don't want to leave you guys, how does that work? Okay. If you want, tomorrow night, you can ask whatever you want, and then tomorrow night, Bezachem, we'll deal with it. Tomorrow night, it's Thursday night, we have class, Bezachem. The Kohen is prohibited from marrying a zona. What is a zona? So, a zona is a woman that had relations with someone that is biblically prohibited, meaning if a girl was a virgin, and then she wasn't religious, so she lived with a guy, that doesn't necessarily make her into a zona. That doesn't mean she's necessarily prohibited from marrying a kohen. There's a machlokas here, Ramban Rashi. What's included? Is it only women? Is it only relationships that the Torah says are chavei kritut? Or is it also inclusive of relationships that are chavei lavin? That the Torah just says don't do it, but the Torah doesn't give that weighty of a punishment if one does do it. For example, if you have Ammoni or Moavi, someone from Ammonites or Moabites, the Torah says we may not marry into them. But if one does, it's not kares, it's just it's a lav, it's prohibited, but it's not kares. According to Rashi, if a woman lived with one of them, so then she would be a zona, and according to Ramban, she would not be. The Torah says we have a special mitzvah, v'kidashto, to give holiness to a kohen. And this includes that when we're benching, so we let the kohen bench first, when we give aliyas and shul, so the kohen goes up and makes the blessing first. A kohen could be mochel on his kavod. A kohen could say, I'll forgo it. And that's why when we bench, so we say, birshut kohen, do I have the permission of the kohen? That I'm leading the benching, and really I should be giving it to him. If he gives me permission, I'll do it. Now, birshut doesn't always mean I'm asking for permission. Birshut could also mean I'm asking for permission as a form of modesty. Really, I'm supposed to be doing what I'm doing and no one else has a right to do it. But out of modesty, I'm not assuming that position of authority. Meaning when the leader of the house makes kiddush, or when he makes hamotzi, he's supposed to be making hamotzi. He doesn't need anyone else's permission. This is his house. But out of modesty, we say whenever you're going to represent other people, ask them for permission. Even though they can't really say no. Out of modesty, don't assume positions of representation or positions of authority. Just as when Bezalel was appointed as the leader to construct the Mishkan, God told Moshe, go ask the Jews. Go tell them, as the Jews said, he's a 13-year-old. He's going to lead the construction of the Mishkan. So Moshe took out an old, ancient manuscript that they had, that God had showed Adam, in which it said who the leaders of each generation would be. And he said, look, here God already told Adam that in our generation, Bezalel is going to lead the building of the Mishkan. So when the Jews saw that, they said, okay, so it's decreed from heaven, then they accepted Bezalel. So why did Moshe have to ask them? God said, teach the world that even though I'm saying he should build my Mishkan, I still ask the Jews' permission. He's representing them. Yeah?
Why didn't they look further down to see who else was...
Who said they didn't? the Gemara discusses what happened with that book.
Where does the Gemara discuss
the book?
I think it's in Sanhedrin, but I'm not sure. The Torah tells us that if the Kohen Gadol loses a relative, Umina Mikdash lo yetzei, he should not leave the Mikdash, the temple. So one understanding is he doesn't leave at all. a regular kohen, if he loses his wife, God forbid, or his sister, or brother, or parent, so then he has to go and help in their burial. That's his mitzvah. And here there are two opinions as to what happens here. There's machlokes Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Yishmael on a few mitzvos. There are certain mitzvos where the Torah says don't, and then the Torah says do. And the question is, when the Torah says do, did the Torah say you must, or the Torah said you may? The Torah says you're not allowed to hate your fellow man. Not allowed to. You're supposed to love every fellow man. You're not allowed to hate a fellow Jew. Now, this obviously includes your wife. The Torah says if one sees his wife going off with in places where it's immodest and he suspects what's going on there, he may tell her, I don't want you to do this, and if you do, I'm going to give you the soto waters, please don't do this. Is the Torah saying he must do that or he may do that? He's not allowed to hate his wife. He's not allowed to be upset like this, to threaten her with soto waters. So when the Torah says he may, is the Torah saying he must or he may? The Torah says a kohen may not become tameh for anyone else. And then the Torah says, but his sister, father, mother, son, daughter, sister, brother, son, daughter, wife, right? For them he may. Is it he may or he must? So there are two opinions in the Gemara on these two and one more example. Is it that he may or he must? And the Gemara brings a story that there was a kohen that he lost his sister and he didn't want to become tameh, and his brothers the kohanim shoved him and they said, we know you want to bring the paschal offering, you want to bring the Korban Pesach, and if you go to the funeral and become tameh, you won't do it, but we rule halachically that you must, you have a mitzvah, you don't have a choice, so you won't bring the Korban Pesach, and they forced him to become tameh. So a regular kohen, if after he loses a relative he wants to serve in the Beis HaMikdash, so his service is nullified. We say that doesn't work. The service that he does then is pasul. It's not kosher. A kohen gadol, the Torah says, mina mikdash lo yetze. If the high kohen, if he loses a relative, even the closest relative, he continues doing the avodah in the Beis HaMikdash. And the question is the Torah just telling us that he could continue doing the service, or is the Torah prohibiting him from leaving the temple? Meaning, let's say he says, I want to attend my father's funeral. I want to be there. May he do that? So one opinion says, no, he may not. When the Torah says he may not leave the temple, he may not leave. Another opinion says, no. All the Torah is telling us is that if he did continue doing service there, it's kosher. Now, the way they used to do a funeral here is that the Kohen Gadol's father would be led in a procession, and he'd hide. And when they turned the corner, he'd come. He'd always be one corner behind them. Meaning as they turned the corner, he'd turn a corner. And this was a way of ensuring that the kohen would not fall on his father's... we know when Yosef lost his father, so he fell on his father's bed. He jumped on it. And I don't know how many funerals you guys have been to. This is a common thing. The relatives jump on the body. So the rabbis were concerned that a kohen gadol might jump on the body. So there's a machlokas. Did the rabbis institute that he may not attend the funeral at all? Or did they just institute that he always has to be one corner behind everyone else? I don't know what the halach is. Let's see, it's Rabbi Meir of Rabbi Yehuda. I think halach is Rabbi Yehuda, that he may not leave at all.
This is all only possible before the time that this
could
have been
codified.
The time that
Salah could have... Maybe there's a maskana. I don't know. The Torah enumerates all kinds of blemishes. A kohen that's been castrated, a kohen that's missing the bridge of his nose, a kohen that has abnormal sized limbs. And this isn't a complete listing. These are avot. These are like fathers. They're an extension of each of these blemishes that if a kohen has, he may not serve in the Beit HaMikdash. Right.
What's that?
There
are toledot
of these? Yeah, toledot. Yeah, there are expansions of these. So their job would be to take out the worms from the wood, to prepare the wood for the altar. The kohanim with mumim. I don't know. Okay. If a kohen marries a woman that he is forbidden to, so he has transgressed two prohibitions. There's a myth going around, I don't know of any basis for it, that if a kohen falls in love with a woman that he is forbidden to marry, then he may forego his kahuna and marry her. In our parsha, it says two biblical prohibitions. One for the engagement and two for every time he lives with her. On a coin, marrying a woman that he's prohibited to marry. So, I don't know. I didn't research this issue, but I don't know where people are coming from that people are saying this. A coin may not marry a divorced woman. A coin may not marry a halala. Let's say a woman, her father was a Kohen and he married a divorced woman. So then that daughter is a halala. A Kohen may not marry that daughter. We say that by his having an improper relationship, this Kohen, so his offsprings are now all called halalim, Kohanim that were defiled, and a Kohen may not marry them. So I don't know, people are saying this, and I don't know where they're... I heard it from more than one place, and I don't know where they're coming from.
I'll help you find that.
Okay. I'm waiting. Okay. I'm waiting.
Yeah.
What about someone who is a Kohen at birth, but he can't go like this?
So he's still a Kohen.
If
he could do it, good. Mama.
Yeah,
as a kid, I spent hours doing this. I couldn't do it. I trained myself. You can practice. It's a pity.
what is it? Why is she?
I don't know. You have to ask the Kabbalist. A person whose the bridge of his nose is missing is called Charum. And here there's an interesting Ramban. I'm going to quote it because it was fascinating to me. There's a pasuk in Shir HaShirim that says, Apech kemigdal ha-Levanon, which seems to say, your nose is big like the towers in the Lebanon. So Rashi says on that pasuk, I can't explain that the pasuk's talking about the nose, because what beauty is there in a nose that's sticking up and big like a tower? So that's what Rashi says. So Rashi says, must be, the pasuk says, apeich, it's talking about apaim, your face, it's like the towers in Lebanon. That's what Rashi says. So I remember reading that Rashi and smiling, and then...
Maybe it's not so big after this.
In our parsha, the Torah calls a person who is missing the bridge of his nose charum, and the Ramban says the reason he's called charum is because the glory of the face is the bridge of the nose, and we see the Gemara says if a person wants to testify that someone else died, the person was at war, and they saw someone else dying, and they want to testify for the wife that it was their husband, the Gemara says he must see the face with the bridge of the nose. So the Ramban says, we see the bridge of the nose is central to the face. So I would have said, yeah, it's central, it's the middle. But the Ramban says, no, it is. The bridge of the nose represents the glory of the face. And if a person doesn't have a bridge of the nose, so then his looks are destroyed. And that's why it's called Charum, like Cheren. Cheren is destroyed. If you destroy a city totally, that's called Cheren. So this person is called Charum, a person whose face is totally destroyed. So maybe, if the Ramban is saying that it has such importance, maybe the Ramban would learn the Pasuk in Shir HaShirim differently than Rashi. The Torah tells us that if someone eats Truma, so we know the Truma is the holy food that's taken off and given to the Kohanim, he must add a fifth. And the question is, what does the Torah mean when the Torah discusses fractions? So there's a machlokas in all of Shas. How do we do math in the Torah? It's called milibar or milagav. When the Torah says that you have to add a fifth, does the Torah mean, let's say you ate 100, so you divide it by 5, and now you pay back 120, right? That's one understanding of a fifth. Or, when the Torah says a fifth, does the Torah mean add a fifth portion, which will be equal to the first four portions, meaning take the 100, divide it by 4, and you get 25, and add a fifth portion equal to the first four. Meaning when the Torah says a fraction, does the Torah mean that fraction of the number, or does the Torah mean, no, that's a fraction of the whole number, take a fourth of the number, and then add a fifth portion that's equal to a fourth. You guys with me? Should we do a few examples?
No.
You guys all got it? So this is a machlokas throughout Shas, and it's called milibar or milagav. And guess what? We paskin
Milabar, we paskin that you do math the way we wouldn't think to do math. That when the Torah says a fifth, it means what we call modern math, a fourth. It means a fifth section equal to the first four. Lars, you're with us? You're with us, okay. So if you're all so with me, I want to tell you another way of understanding the same concept, and the mathematicians among you will understand why it's just two ways of saying the same thing. When we say a fifth of a hundred, do we mean a fifth of the hundred? Or do we mean a fifth of the final product? Meaning, add 25, you get 125. 25 is one fifth of 125. That's another way of explaining it, which is more complicated, which is the way I grew up with. But I think it's better to... It's right. If you think about it, it's the same thing. Where is it going to be different? I'll tell you where the difference comes in. We say that you have to take off challah. You have to give challah from the volume of an omer. Now, an omer is the tenth of an eifa. And to make a long story short, an eifa equals 18 kav. So you have to take a tenth of 18, and from that you will subtract you will detract the challah. You're going to take the challah off of it. And we don't discuss how much challah you take off. So now you can't do the math the second way we discussed. Meaning now you can't say, I'll take the global volume, because you're detracting. Everything we said is very good when you're adding the fifth. What happens when you're subtracting a fifth? If the Torah tells me, subtract, take a fifth off, now my final product is not going to be 125. So that's where you have to apply the first understanding. That why would a fifth be what we call today a fourth? Because it means take a fifth portion which equals to the first four. You guys with me? But here, it's why is it problematic? Because here, it would seem to make less sense. Why would the Torah call a portion that I'm taking off a fifth portion? When I'm adding it, you could say, well, divide my hundred into four portions and add a fifth portion equal to the first quarters. But when I'm subtracting it, so I'm not having a fifth portion here. I'm going to end up with three portions. So why call it a fifth? You guys with me? That's why it's a bit problematic. So you could hypothesize many things. I don't have an answer to that.
Sort of intuitive,
when
you say a third off, that means
that
there's
going to
be two-thirds left.
Right. So then what is the third?
The third of the original amount. Otherwise, it's not.
But it's not. We paskin that a tenth of 18 is 9. A tenth of 18 isn't 9, right? It's 1.8.
Mm-hmm.
And in this mathematical equation, which is relevant in halacha, how we evaluate how much you have to make in order to be chayv challah, we say you do a tenth of 18, and that's 9.
Sure.
Now you're going to take off from that the challah. However much you'll take off, that's rabbinic. Biblically, you could take off a kernel, you could take off as much as you want, a kol shu. So how does a tenth become a 9? The Torah identifies an omer is a tenth of an eifa. How does a tenth become a ninth when you're not adding anything?
Because
you're identifying a volume. The Torah is identifying what is the volume.
Is it because you've transgressed now, you're probably just taking on the status of...
Has nothing to do with transgression. No.
Uh-huh.
No. You make a certain volume of dough, you have to take off a mitzvah, taking off challah. Yeah. What the halachic ruling is that we do milabar, where it's not so relevant today. There aren't we don't really have holy truma, we don't really have kachim today, and it's relevant to how we do the math of figuring out challah. It's relevant to a few things, but not it's hardly relevant.
The same logic, you should actually take more or less. If you give, you give more, then we take away.
Oh,
less.
Okay. But we don't do that. We say that a tenth of 18, we say is 9. Now, really, if we were applying that logic, then it should be 1/11 of 18.
Right.
Right. And we don't do it that way. Okay. I didn't come to solve the problem. I came to explain to you what's bothering me. The Torah forbids us from castrating animals. There's a biblical prohibition in our parsha to castrate an animal, and this applies today, and this applies to any animal. This applies to kosher animals and non-kosher animals as well. And any form, I don't know of any leniency regarding different forms of castrating animals, be it neutering with spray. I don't know of leniencies.
I heard of someone who had a cat that had to get serviced, that had to get castrated or something. So the person got advice that if he sold it to a goy, then they took it to a goy vet or something.
Okay.
And that was one way.
Then it's not your animal. The Torah begins the commandments of the sacrifices with an ox or a sheep. And the question is why these animals, and why begin with these? So the Midrash says, a mashal, a king hears that people are talking that his wife cheated with a certain officer. So he sends his CIA and all those detectives, they do their research, and they come back and they tell him, never happened. It's all a bunch of baloney. It's lies. So the king says, how am I going to convince everyone that it's all lies, that my wife never cheated on me and this officer never cheated on me? So the king takes the officer and he makes a party, and he honors this officer to sit right near him at the party. Everyone sees that this officer is his favorite officer. And by doing that, everyone sees the king verified it's all lies. The nations were saying to the Jews, you all did the eagle, you served the golden calf. And Hashem said, let me check it out, so to speak. And Hashem said, not true. We find that when the eagle was done, the people who wanted to serve the eagle said, Eile Elohecha Yisrael. Israel, these are your gods. Well, if you're one of them, so why do you have to call out to Israel and say, these are your gods, Israel, that took you out of Egypt? So our sages had a tradition that the ones who started the worship of the calf were the Erev Rav that came along. And that's why they spoke in third person. They said, you guys, this is your god, this calf. And we paid a price for those actions. We should have reacted more harshly. But God wanted to show that he verified the story of the golden calf, so to speak, like this king verified the story that people were saying about his wife. And God said, the Jews are not guilty in my heavenly court. So God said, the first animal I'm going to discuss with them to bring into my temple as a sacrifice is the ox. The ox, the calf, that animal. Now, why do we bring these animals specifically? An ox, a sheep, a goat. So Chazal teach us that God cares for those that are being chased. God says, I'm with those that are the underdogs. That's one of the reasons, one of the signs of God's greatness. You say, Hallel HaGadol, what's great about the great praise? That we discuss how God helps even the most impoverished. God says, I'm from the top, I look at everyone. And I take note of those that are suffering. So the Midrash says, where is it? Just a second. Yeah. Cain was giving Hevel a hard time. So God saw Hevel's plea, and when they brought sacrifices, God showed that he liked Hevel's and not Cain's. Noah's generation, they were giving him a hard time. So God made a point of stressing v'noach matzachin b'nei Hashem. Noach finds favor in his eyes. Avram is being chased by the king who is the most powerful king in the time, Nimrod. And God shows the world that he has chosen Avram. Yitzhak is being chased by the Philistines. So God brings the Philistines to the knees, and the Philistines say, we recognize that God is with you, let's make a pact with you. Yaakov is being chased by Esav. So, ki Yaakov bachal lokai Yisrael iskulato. God takes Israel to be his chosen one. Yosef is chased by his brothers. God makes a special sign that he is with Yosef, even out down in Egypt. He's successful. Moshe is being chased by Paro. God sends Moshe. Moshe is brought back to stand and save the Jewish people. The Jews are chased. And God tells the Jewish people, you're my chosen people. And that's why God chose these animals. An ox is chased by lions. A sheep is chased by wolves. A goat is chased by leopards. God says, the animals that are chased, they're the animals that you could bring before me to as sacrifices. Don't bring me animals that chase. Bring the animals that get chased. The nations, when they want to serve their gods, so they want to show, I got the paw of a bear. I got the head of a lion. God says, take your domesticated animals, take the animals you have at home. That's not the point. We have a tradition that the main part of a sacrifice is the flower offering. The mincha, that's the main part. But you bring a whole animal, you spend a lot of money on the animal, and the wine, and the flower. God says, that's what I want, the flower. Halacha is like Rabbi Akiva. Says the main part of the sacrifice is the small amount of flour that we bring with it. The Torah tells us that we must wait till the eighth day. You can't bring an animal as a sacrifice before it's lived 7 days. And the Midrash says, a mashal to a king that enters the city, and he says, anyone that wants to see me has to meet my queen first. So too Hashem said to the Jewish people, no one could come and bring me a sacrifice. I will not meet up with any sacrifice you bring me unless it meets my queen first. What is God's queen? Shabbos. And so Hashem said, I don't accept an animal for a sacrifice, and I don't accept a human being to have a circumcision, a bris milah, until 7 days have passed to ensure that they meet up with my queen first with Shabbos. So no child gets circumcised, bris milah, no Jewish child gets before he's 8 days old. And no animal could be brought before they've had 8 days to meet with Shabbos. The Torah tells us, "V'lot chalut shem kodshiv nikdashtiv toch bnei Yisrael ni Hashem mikadishchem." We have a prohibition of chilul Hashem. Chilul Hashem is probably the most weighty sin there is. We say that different sins a person can atone for in different ways. Sometimes a person can do tshuva, and that's enough. Sometimes we say Hashem will make him suffer in this world and then he'll get forgiveness. Chilul Hashem, Hashem says, if a person causes God's name to be desecrated, so Yom Kippur, if he has Yom Kippur, and he does tshuva, and he suffers in this world, then when he dies, that'll be an atonement. But, but Chilul Hashem is so serious. Hashem says, I'm willing to forgo Avodah Zarah. Hashem tells the prophet, the Jews did Avodah Zarah, I'll forgive them for that. They served other gods, idol worship I can forgive, but Chilul Hashem I can't forgive. And this is something we have to take to heart. We stand in line, we're wearing a yarmulke, we're looked at, we're the Jew. If a person cuts in line, so he's looked at, and Chilul Hashem is not only with regard to non-Jews, Chilul Hashem is with regard to Jews as well. And it's a question of how we treat our fellow men. If someone looks at us and says, that's how a Jew behaves, that's how a religious Jew behaves, that's Chilul Hashem. Now, you have people who just like saying that. Like, whatever you do, they'll say, that's how a religious Jew behaves. So we're not talking about those people. But sometimes there are real instances where people feel that's how a religious Jew behaves. And if we cause anyone to feel that way, and it doesn't matter if it's a Jew or a non-Jew, That's Chilul Hashem. If a person does a sin before many people, that's also Chilul Hashem. Once there are 10 people present, a person says does a sin, that's Chilul Hashem. The Rabbein Bechaye teaches us something very interesting in our parsha. He says there is a way to fix Chilul Hashem. Chazal taught us if a person did Lashon Hara, so he sinned with his mouth, he could fix it by dealing with Torah. If a person sinned with his eyes, so he should cry in his prayers. Person saw things that are improper, so the tears that he cries in tshuva, that's what's going to give him atonement. The Chazal say, if a person did a package of averos, he should do a package of mitzvos to counterbalance them. If a person ran with his feet to sin, to do averos, let him run with his feet to do mitzvos. If a person's hands spilled clean blood, then he should use those same hands to put on tefillin and to give charity, tzedakah, to the poor. Our sages tell us that Hurdus, the king Herod, he killed out the sages. And he killed many rabbis. And he felt very bad about it. So he turned to Shimon ben Shetach, the one sage he knew was still around, and he asked him, Shimon ben Shetach was in hiding. His sister, Shlimtzion, was married to Hurdus, and she hid him. She was scared he'd kill him. One time, he was... Okay, it's a long story. At any rate, so he asked Shimon ben Shetach, what should I do? So Shimon ben Shetach said, you put out the light of the world. You killed all the sages. So you have to bring light back to the world. Rebuild the temple. Make a glorious temple. And that's when we have the great temple of Herod. He did it as an atonement for all the rabbis that he had killed. The pasuk says, "V'nikdashti b'toch bnei Yisrael." There's a special mitzvah to do a kiddush Hashem, and the Rabbeinu Bechaye says the fact that the pasuk puts them together, the juxtaposition is there to teach us that that's a way of atoning for chil Hashem by doing kiddush Hashem. I think people are tired. I think we're going to call it a night. No. We'll continue tomorrow night. I see heads drooping. Go to sleep. We'll continue tomorrow night. Bezach Hashem.